special night. It's a ceremony that Jesus gave to us as his people almost 2,000 years ago. So what we're going to do is, I trust, I pray, is prepare ourselves for that by looking at Mark chapter 10. So if you would, go ahead and turn to Mark chapter 10. We do thank you for partnering with us as we desire to go to France with the good news about Jesus that we're going to celebrate tonight. We are at 80%, or right around 80%, and our desire, what we've been asking God and planning for, is to move at the end of this year, if it's his will. So you can pray about that. Before we begin, I'll just mention I did bring a few cards. If you don't have one of our cards to remember us by, please take it. And also, you can sign up for updates by email if you so wish. That's in the back. We're going to be in Mark chapter 10, and we're going to read a few verses beginning. I forgot to turn this on, so excuse me. Beginning at verse 35. Mark 10, verse 35. And James and John, the sons of Zebedee, come unto him, saying, Master, we would that thou shouldst do for us whatsoever we shall desire. And he, Jesus, said unto them, What would ye that I should do for you? And they said unto him, Grant unto us that we may sit, one on thy right hand, and the other on thy left, on thy left hand, in thy glory. But Jesus said unto them, Ye know not what ye ask. Can ye drink of the cup that I drink of, and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? And they said unto him, We can. And Jesus said unto them, Ye shall indeed drink of the cup that I drink of. And with the baptism that I am baptized withal, shall ye be baptized. But to sit on my right hand and on my left hand is not mine to give, but it shall be given to them for whom it was prepared. It is prepared. And when the 10 heard it, they began to be much displeased with James and John. But Jesus called them to him and saith unto them, Ye know that they which are accounted to rule over the Gentiles exercise lordship over them. And their great ones exercise authority upon them. But so shall it not be among you. But whosoever will be great among you shall be your minister. And whosoever of you will be the chiefest shall be servant of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister, and to give his life a ransom for many. And these are the words of the Lord for us tonight. So let's ask him to help us understand them. Father, we come to you in Jesus' name, and we know that this passage is about him, and that what we are to learn from this is about him and how he, as Lord, should affect us. So we ask that you would open our eyes to this. Help us to understand how this applies to us, how it should move us to worship him and to serve him in this life. And we ask you to do this for his sake and for our good. Amen. Tonight, we're going to focus not on that entire passage. We're actually just going to focus on two verses, verses 38 and 39. And specifically, what I want us to look at is this idea of a cup. What does Jesus mean by the fact that he's got to drink a cup and that the disciples are going to drink a cup? And in order for us to do that, we need to begin by understanding the setting of this episode in Jesus' life. Okay? So when you're picturing this in your mind, think they're not sitting around a coffee table. They're actually moving toward a place, toward Jerusalem. And for Jesus and the disciples, Jerusalem is a place of danger. Okay, now how do we know that Jerusalem is a place of danger? Well, if we just look up a little bit in Mark chapter 10, at verses 32, we read, They were in their way going up to Jerusalem, and Jesus went before them, and they were amazed, and as they followed, they were afraid. Now, why would good Jews be afraid to go to Jerusalem? Well, we know from Mark's story, if we follow it from the beginning, beginning in chapter 3, we know that the scribes who were from Jerusalem were Jesus' enemies, right? So they come and they hear Jesus, what's going on, they check him out, and their official proclamation in chapter 3, verse 22 of Mark, is that Jesus is in league with Satan. Okay, so they come down hard against him. This man is not from God. He's actually on the opposite team. A little later on in chapter 7 of Mark, we find that the scribes from Jerusalem are kind of tailing Jesus. They're keeping their eye on him. They're a little suspicious. And as they watch him, they're looking for reasons to jump on him. And in chapter 7, they jump on him because his disciples eat grain without the ritual washings. And so they're unclean. They're after him. These are not his friends, and they are from the religious establishment in Jerusalem, and that's where he's going. We also know that he should be frightened that there is danger ahead in Jerusalem because he has begun telling his disciples in chapter 8 that I must go to Jerusalem and die at the hands of the high priest. Now, the high priest lives in Jerusalem. He's telling them this in chapter 8, verse 31, following the transfiguration. He goes ahead and tells them two more times. The next time in chapter 9, verse 31, he tells the disciples that he will be betrayed and killed by executioners, the hands of men, the Romans, and the Jewish leadership, and then the Romans. And then in the third prophecy, we learn that Jesus will be killed by the Gentiles, which to a Jew would have been a sure sign of his condemnation by God. And then we learn a few more details about his execution. That's right before we come to our section of Mark chapter 10, verses 33 through 34 is where that third prophecy is. So when you think about Jesus talking about the cup, we need to realize he is talking about the cup under the shadow of death, his imminent death as he arrives at Jerusalem. He's prophesied that they are going to kill him. And when he looks at these two, James and John, and says, "Can you drink my cup?" Whatever he means by cup must be interpreted within this context, a context of danger and death for Jesus. So that's the setting of the passage. So what happens in our passage? Well, let's just walk through the sequence, okay? And let's just think through this conversation as it takes place with Jesus. In verses 35 through 37 in chapter 10, two disciples, James and John, come to Jesus and they say, "We want privileged positions in the kingdom." Okay? That's their request. Verse 38, Jesus looks at them and says, "You have no idea what you're asking." And then he asks them a question that doesn't seem to fit the context, right? He looks at them, the two guys who are asking him for a position in his kingdom, and he says, "Can you drink the cup that I'm going to drink? And can you be baptized with the baptism I'm going to be baptized with?" Verse 39, they say yes. Verses 39 through 40, Jesus tells them that they will indeed drink his cup and be baptized with his baptism. And then he addresses what really concerns them by telling them, "Well, that's not for me to say. Okay, I can't give you that position. It's already been given to whom it will be given." Verse 41, the other disciples are indignant when they find out about this, and they're upset. Verses 42 through 44, Jesus addresses this whole mindset of selfishness. He takes this as a teaching opportunity. He teaches them what true greatness in his kingdom is. And then in verse 45, he gives them the basis or the standard for what true greatness in his kingdom is. It's his own sacrificial ransom that he is going to make, his death that's going to make the ransom for others. Now, why walk through the sequence? Okay, remember, the setting is death. It's imminent. The sequence is Jesus is asked a question. He gives an answer that doesn't seem to fit what they want. And then he takes care of the personal issues of these people that makes them want to be the top guns. I think if we carefully consider these verses, we see that there are two different themes that are developed. Now, the most obvious theme is the one that you probably think of immediately when you hear this passage read, and that is the theme of service in the kingdom, right? Those who serve are the ones who are great in the kingdom. Don't strive to be a lord over everyone else. And that is there. Jesus teaches about that. But he also raises a second theme. And he raises the second theme by bringing up this idea of a cup and a baptism. What does he mean when he asks these questions? Why does he ask these questions? I mean, think through the sequence. Jesus could have looked at them and said, "You don't know what you're asking. And it's not my place to give away those positions." And then gone on to teach them that you're being proud and selfish, and here's what true greatness is. But he doesn't do that. He brings up the idea of a cup, and we need to know why. And in order for us to know why, we need to understand the details of these two verses. So let's jump in to the significant details of these two verses. Detail number one is that the disciples had a specific expectation. That expectation is that the glory was coming soon, and they wanted to get in good on it. They wanted to be high up in the glory, that is his kingdom. Now remember, if you're thinking about Jesus' life, he has just come down from the Mount of Transfiguration. What happened there? They saw him revealed in glory. And I can just see the two wheels turning. These men say, the glory's coming. The glory's coming, and we want to be on top when it does. And so they ask him if they can rule with him. The second detail is Jesus' unexpected reply. Why did he bring up something about a cup? Why did he talk about baptism when all they wanted to know was, can we be rulers with you? In order to understand that, we need to understand what Jesus means by the cup. So let's walk through a few things here. I think it's obvious, and you probably understand it's obvious, that when Jesus refers to a cup, he's using a metaphor, right? I mean, he doesn't have a mug in his pocket and say, can you drink from this cup? Now, what is it that he wants to communicate with this metaphor? Well, I think we can understand by remembering the setting. The setting is one where Jesus has death on his mind, his own death. And that's important for us to understand. He is heading toward Jerusalem, and he said, I must die at the hands of other people. It has to happen. And so as he brings up the cup, we need to realize death is in the atmosphere. Third thing we need to understand is, what does he mean by cup? And I think we can have a little bit of help here if we just look a little bit later in Mark's gospel. Chapter 14, verse 36. This is very, very much familiar to us. But when Jesus is praying before he's arrested, we read that he went forward a little and fell on the ground and prayed that, if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. What's he talking about? What hour? The hour of his arrest, conviction, crucifixion, bearing of sin. And he said, verse 36, Abba, Father, all things are possible unto thee. Take away this, what? This cup from me. So if we're just learning from Mark, we learn right there that cup, when it's used in a metaphorical sense, is linked to Jesus' death. And it also occurs in Mark chapter 14, verse 23 as well, at the Lord's, when he's at the Last Supper, and he says, take this cup, this is the new covenant in my blood. So if we just look at Mark, we've got a sense that the cup is linked to Jesus' death. But there's also other metaphorical uses in the New Testament, and we'll just look or think about Revelation chapter 14, verse 10. We read there that the same shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture into the cup of his indignation. And he shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and in the presence of the Lamb. So here, this is just one example of other metaphorical uses in the New Testament. Again, cup is being linked with wrath at this point. The wrath of God that's poured out. And that is in keeping with the Old Testament usages of the cup. Okay? So if we just look, I'll read these. Psalm 11:6. Upon the wicked he shall rain snares, fire and brimstone, and an horrible tempest. This shall be the portion of their cup that they've got to drink, God's wrath. Or Isaiah 51, verse 17. Awake, awake, stand up, O Jerusalem, which has drunk at the hand of the Lord the cup of his fury. Thou hast drunken the dregs of the cup of trembling and wrung them out. Now, what's the point? The point is simply this. When you read Jesus saying, can you drink the cup that I have to drink? What's he referring to? He's referring to his coming death and the wrath of God, the judgment of God on sin that is going to be poured out. So Jesus looks at them and says, you have no idea what you're asking. Can you drink? Can you receive? Can you put yourself under the wrath of God? And I think we know that. Because of the setting of this passage, other metaphorical usages of the cup in Mark and the rest of the New Testament, and the Old Testament background. So what does he mean next by baptism? All right, is he talking about being dipped in water? I don't think that's likely. Here's another metaphorical use that is in fitting with other uses of this word in Greek, both classical Greek as well as the biblical Greek. All I'll do is refer you to Psalm 69, verses 1 and 2. And just listen to this and see, does this remind you of suffering? Save me, O God, for the waters are come in unto my soul. I sink in deep mire where there is no standing. I am come into deep waters where the floods overflow me. Deliver me out of the mire, this is verse 14 of the same psalm, and let me not sink. Let me be delivered from them that hate me and out of the deep waters. Let not the water flood overflow me, neither let the deep swallow me up, and let not the pit shut her mouth upon me. So when Jesus brings up baptism, he's just reinforcing this idea of the cup. There is suffering going on here. The cup gives us the idea that it's Jesus' death and that there is the bearing of wrath. This idea of baptism is like the terror of being drowned and overcome by the furies of water. So, when Jesus looks at James and John and he says, can you drink the cup that I drink? And can you be baptized with the baptism that I baptize? He has in his mind a day coming where he will die and bear the fury of God's wrath against sin. That is what he means. Now, I think it's obvious from just reading the passage that Jesus expects that James and John would say, no, I can't drink the cup you're going to drink. I can't be baptized with the baptism you baptize with. I mean, he's already told them, you have no idea what you're asking. And yet they come out and they say, we can. And Jesus affirms this. And he says, you indeed will. Now, what we need to understand is how can that be so? Okay, if Jesus, by referring to the cup, is referring to his substitutionary death, his death, where he will bear the wrath of God. How is it that he can say James and John will drink that cup? Well, we only have two options. OK? okay, at least as I see it. Our first option is that the meaning of cup has changed from a reference to bearing God's wrath to a reference to suffering in general. So if you read it this way, when Jesus said, "Can you drink my cup?" My cup is bearing God's wrath. Yes, you will drink it. Your cup is just suffering in general. And what this becomes, if you read it this way, is a somewhat cryptic reference to the fact that these two men will suffer in the future for him. That's valid. Some people take that. And really, that's all you're left with unless there is, and I think there is, a second option. And the second option is that the meaning of cup remains the same, but the meaning of drink is a little bit different. Okay? So what Jesus says is that, yes, you will drink it, but you won't drink it the way you're thinking of right now. Rather, you are going to drink it vicariously through me as I drink it. Now, if we're going to take the second option, which I think we should, then there needs to be some kind of hint of substitution or vicariousness, right? You know, you understand, I know. Vicarious, you live through someone vicariously. Or this afternoon I heard someone mention that his wife is nesting vicariously through him. That means he's doing all the work that she wants done, right? You know what it means to do something vicariously, right? Well, if we're going to take the second option, there needs to be something in the passage that should make us think that Jesus has substitution in his mind, his being the substitute. Now, is there anything in this passage that makes us think that? Look at verse 45. Verse 45, "For even the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give his life a ransom," what are the next two words? "For many." That's substitutionary, vicarious language. All right, and I think we can at least look at this and say, this verse, which is part of this entire episode, makes it clear and obvious that Jesus was conscious of the fact that his coming, giving of his life, was an in the place of others death that was going to procure their ransom, right? I mean, that's what he just said. In fact, Jesus says that substitutionary ransom was the reason he was living. It was his mission on earth to go and be a substitutionary ransom for many. Now, I think it's highly doubtful that Jesus knew his mission was to give his life as a ransom for many without knowing how his death was going to accomplish that mission. And what I mean by that is this: Jesus knew that he was going to die in Jerusalem to bear God's wrath for sinners so that they could be ransomed. He knew that. It wasn't a shock. And so when he mentions the cup, he's looking ahead. The wrath is coming. And when he looks at them, he says, "You are going to drink it, but not like you think. You are going to be drinking it through me, through your connection with who I am." I think we have even further evidence for this understanding in Mark chapter 10, verse 45, because of the repetition of this idea of the many in Isaiah chapter 53. When Jesus says, "I am come to give my life a ransom for many," he is, I think, and I think Mark includes this in particular, to cause us to think of Isaiah chapter 53. And when we read Isaiah chapter 53, verses 11 and 12, we read this: "He shall see the travail of his soul and shall be satisfied. By his knowledge shall my righteous servant justify many, for he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore will I divide him a portion with the great, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong. Because he hath poured out his soul unto death, and he was numbered with the transgressors, and he bare the sin of many, and made intercession for the transgressors. There's this idea in Isaiah 53 that the suffering servant, the servant of the Lord, would suffer for the sake of the many. And when Jesus comes along and says, my life is going to be given for the many, I think he's calling us to remember that. He has come to do this work. So, let's just back up, right? When Jesus mentions the cup, he's referring to his drinking the wrath of God against sin. But anyone so far who's been reading Mark's gospel would say, well, wait, isn't Jesus God's Messiah and the Son of God? Why in the world is Jesus, God's Messiah and the Son of God, going to bear God's wrath? Well, it's because James and John do have to drink that cup. And they only have one of two options. They can drink it on their own, fully deserving it, because they have sinned and God's wrath should come on them. Or they can drink it vicariously through a substitute who took that cup and drank God's wrath even though he didn't deserve it. And that's what happened. So when Jesus looks at them and says, you will drink the cup, he could have been looking at any person in here. You will drink the cup. The question is, how will you drink the cup? Will you drink it on your own and be crushed under the wrath of God? Or will you drink it in me? And through your reliance upon me, and in doing so, you will live and survive. Now, I think this has direct implications for what we are about to do as a group of people. You see, we're not that different from James and John, right? James and John were selfish, right? I mean, their crime here was not murder. Their crime here was nothing terrible. They just were trying to edge out the next guy so they could get top billing. But that's who we all are, right? We all want to be number one. And you see it in our homes, right? If we're honest, we can say, yes, we're selfish in our homes. We're selfish at our work. We're selfish with our friends. We're selfish at our coworkers, our neighbors. Whoever we're around, selfishness just leaps up out of us. And what we're doing tonight, all of those who are trusting Jesus and say, yes, I am following him, he is my Savior, what we're doing is we're giving an external act. We are participating in an external rite to say that, yeah, Jesus took the cup for me. Jesus took the baptism for me. He bore the wrath and the punishment that I should have received. And when you come, and I come, and we accept the juice, and we drink that juice, and we eat that bread, we are saying, I am identifying with you, Jesus. You are the one who's going to save me, because I believe that when you took that wrath, you took mine. You didn't deserve it. I did. But because you took it, now I can live forever with God at peace. That is good news. And that's the reason we're coming and reminding ourselves as individuals and as a body that it is only through the broken body of Jesus and his blood that he gave that we have any hope with God in the world. Pastor.